raw, uncut, and unapologetic. Welcome to Men Talking Mindfulness with your hosts John McCaskill and Will Schneider. Here we focus on helping men and those with men in their lives solve some of life's complex challenges through understanding the practices of mindfulness and how they can help. Each episode is in an environment free of judgment and criticism with a focus on authenticity and inner peace. Let's dig in.
Sometimes, especially when we are very young, we have experiences that we cannot shake, even if they seem insignificant, no more substantial than a glass of water. When these upsetting experiences evaporate, they then condense into billions of droplets of anger, fear, self-doubt, guilt, and other negative feelings surrounding us with a suffocating blanket that suffocates every aspect of our lives for years to come. We call this the fog of distress. Typically, this vague sense of unease parks itself in the background like the annoying hum of a refrigerator or air conditioner we have learned to block out from our conscious awareness. But whether we are aware of it or not, it pervades our existence like an insistent headache, interfering with our ability to have healthy relationships, to perform to our potential at work, or to have lives that are anywhere near as fulfilling as it could be. Over the years, that background hum can sabotage our career, friendships, marriages. Sometimes, even our health starts to suffer.
And don't allow this quote from The Code to Joy to cause you distress. There is a way out of this fog, and this is what John and I are going to talk about today. Our first episode with this book and with one of its authors, Dr. George Pratt, was littered with audio and other technical issues that dropped well below our standards of quality podcasting. So we decided to revisit this important book, providing you with a summary by breaking down its essential elements with the hopes to help you become aware of what is getting in the way of having a more joyful life and what you can do about it. So get ready for another fun and enlightening episode of Men Talking Mindfulness. Thank you all for being here, for tuning in, for sharing our podcast, for helping us grow, and for becoming more mindful. Let's jump in. John, great to see you. Good to be back. We're doing a little solo episode. We just talked before we got on the air how much we love just John and I rapping back and forth in this podcast. So thanks, everybody, for listening and tuning in. Just a couple short announcements. You know, buy our merch, please. Merch store is open. You can head to mentalkingmindfulness.com/shop. We have hats and tees and, you know, tumblers and I don't know what else we got on there. We have a lot of stuff. Yeah, the hats. Or hats.
I've got my tumbler in my van down there. I should have brought it up.
Yeah, mine are coming in the mail tomorrow, so I can't wait to sport some of that new MTM merch. So thanks for supporting us, and also support us on social. Anywhere on social, search Men Talking Mindfulness, and you can find us, or just go to @MenTalkingMindfulness, and you can find us that way. All right, we're going to just jump in, do our grounding breath practice so we can center and focus and provide you with maybe a little bit of levity right now. Well, let's just do a little bit of cross hand breathing, which is part of the book. So take your right hand and bring it across over to the left side of your chest and take your left hand and do the opposite on the right side of your chest. Maybe cross your ankles if you can. And let's just start with an exhale. We're just going to do 5 breaths. Exhale out. Feeling that contact of you and your body and your breath, and take a big breath in through your nose and let it go out. Grounding yourself and maybe imagine yourself being tethered deeply, deeply into the core of the earth. Again, in and gently out. Three more. Big inhale. Deep inhale, exhale, let it go. And last two in. Maybe the exhale, you melt a little bit deeper into the here and now by releasing some tension in your face, jaw, shoulders, hips, and last one, inhale. And let it go. Great. All right. Come back. Those little movements. And great. Good to be back, John. I guess we should actually show the book, huh?
Right here.
That we're reading today.
Yeah.
There you go. John's got Green a code screens. To joy. yep.
There it is. Code to joy. The four-step solution to unlocking your natural state of happiness by Dr. George Pratt and Dr. Peter Lambro. So, yeah, I forgot how to pronounce that. So there we go.
It's bro. That's all good.
So excited to get in this conversation. We definitely owe the book and the authors more than what we gave it last week. Just, I mean, we tried to give it all, the audio and video, just, hey, we've got the challenges of the universe, you know, and we try to go raw, uncut, and unapologetic. So we're not going to apologize for that. It's just what it was.
Yeah.
But we're redoing it because we owe this to the authors and the book. But more importantly, we owe it to you all. We owe it to you all. Because there are some great nuggets on how to get to that joyful place in this book. And we started off talking about that quote of the fog of distress. So let's talk about that. In the book, they talk about the fact that it only takes about a glass of water to cause fog. I forget what it was, but I think it was a square mile, maybe even more. A glass of water can cause fog. And that metaphor translates to the micro traumas that we have in our lives and how what may be seemingly insignificant to us. As a matter of fact, most of his clients, his patients, when they identify a micro trauma, they say, oh, you know what? There was this thing back when I was 5 or 7 or whenever it wasn't a big deal, or it's probably not significant. But more often than not, it is significant. It's that glass of water that is causing a fog of distress in your life, is causing that hum in the subconscious. And we're going to get into the subconscious versus the conscious here later in this episode. But it causes that annoyance, that anxiety, that disturbance enough to where you don't even realize it's doing it, but it is. And that is, you know, something in the book, they talk about one of the very highly successful ladies who was running a company. And then when she was 5 years old, she had gotten like 25 cents from her aunt for helping her to move some furniture. And when she got home, this was the first money she had ever made when she was 5 or maybe it was 7. And she bragged about it to her family. She said, hey, you know what? Aunt so-and-so paid me a quarter to help her. And they're like, how dare you take money from family? And they belittled her at the dining room table in front of everybody else. So in the back of her mind, it was not okay to make money. And because of that micro trauma, it affected her ability to make money in the future and to feel good about doing it. And she actually inadvertently self-sabotaged her life and then even self-sabotaged the company. But when she was able to identify this micro trauma, she was able to overcome it and then get the company back up and running and then get her life back on track. And so that's an example of, you know, a micro trauma, and they go into many others. But I'm sure our listeners will, myself, we all have some micro traumas. I mean, I'm sure it's more than one. And if we can go back and identify those and then do the four-step process, which they talk about and we'll talk about here in this episode, the four-step process to getting past those, then we can be on the road to joy. And that's why we, again, felt it so important to redo this episode with you all. So,
yeah, we all have these experiences, and I thought it was interesting. I love the way that they put this, the fog of distress, because, you know, it's not like a fog doesn't really bother us. If you think about a fog, it's kind of inhibits our vision, inhibits a broader perspective. It inhibits like clarity and like kind of seeing a bigger picture and you knowing that we're kind of part of a whole. It kind of locks us into and isolates us into its own, the thinking of it, you know, the fog of distress. And then really one of the reasons it's so, these micro traumas and this fog of distress is so incredibly destructive, because it creates a pattern in the mind. And we might, you know, when we're so, what I love, really enjoy about the book when he talks about micro traumas, is when we are so young, and we don't have a lot of language in order to describe our experience. Like, we, you know, think about, I mean, you have a, you know, your kids are continually getting better at speaking, and but they're still human beings. And, you know, your 2 year old is much different than, how old's mine now? Six? Is that six, your oldest? Yeah. Is six? Yeah. You know, but she has a much better vocabulary, but still a lot of gaps in that vocabulary to really fully describe her experience. And plus, she's still a child. So even, you know, when we're at the very early formative years, and because of the lack of language that we have, it integrates in a different way into our consciousness, because of that lack of language. And therefore, we don't necessarily, when we get older and we're like, something is running in the background and kind of dictating, and we're going to talk about the flea and the elephant. It's like the elephant is this subconscious, this big, heavy part of ourselves that just like, why do I keep repeating the same patterns? Why do I keep doing the same thing? And it's from, a lot of it could come from upbringing, just like Stephanie in the book was the name of that, you know, the quarter thing that you talked about. She came home so proud, you know, like, oh, I made a quarter. And like, and she was really, really proud. And then was immediately, it turned into devastation for her because she was shunned for taking money, you know, something, a quarter, taking money from family. And that just kept running in the background all the time, until she was starting to identify it, you know, went into therapy and then helped moving through this 4-step process. You know, I just thought, go ahead, John, if you have
Well, real quick. Say. Yeah. I mean, yep. you mentioned, you know, or we both mentioned these micro traumas that we've experienced, but also yep. you brought up, you know, my children, and as yep. a parent, reading the book was very eye-opening about the little things that we may do that profoundly affect our children that we may not even notice. Like, I'm sure Stephanie in the book, I'm sure her parents didn't think twice about it. They thought they were teaching her an important life lesson. Hey, don't take money from family. But in doing so, they actually humiliated her and made her really suffer through the rest of her life in one way or another. So there's definitely two sides to this coin in reading this book, especially as a parent. You know, what affected me growing up, and then what am I doing to my children, and am I aware of that? And if I am aware of it, what can I do to change it? So it's it's an important read, even if you feel that you are 100% happy and you are living this hunky-dory life and can't change anything to be better, maybe give it a read to see what you do affects others and how to manage that and keep from potentially causing these micro traumas in others' lives. Mm-hmm.
And one thing, we really, all this kind of drops us in these, it drops us into that emotional realm. So out of the mind, it's like how we're feeling. Like, do we feel the sense of guilt or shame or embarrassment? And that's where these, you know, the feelings that we have from these, quote unquote, you know, I guess, transgressions of like a norm or something like that, or crossing a line, or, you know, or just being a kid that doesn't know any better, right? And then we're scolded in some way, like, and we feel a certain way. And then, you know, oh, I'm like a bad kid. We're going to talk about that's a limiting belief. Oh, I'm bad. You know, what is that? How does that haunt us? How does that kind of follow us around a little bit? But I feel we're pretty good on these micro traumas, well, if you will. I mean, yeah,
let's get vulnerable. You got super vulnerable in our episode with Dr. Pratt. So let's talk a little bit. You know, he asked us whether we had any traumas ourselves, and we talked about you know, your camera incident, and you know, then he transitioned to me and being in the SEAL teams, and definitely I've got major traumas from that, but I'll tell you, some of the things that really resonated with me from the book were, he talked about moves, like a move from one location to the next as a child, moving from one school where you know everybody to another school where you know no one, and how that could be considered a micro trauma. And at first I was like, man, that's ridiculous. That's so, come on, man. And then I thought, you know what? I moved to the States when I was 7. I had started first grade. I had, you know, an established friendship or friendships in South Africa, and I left all those friends. And then there was a culture shock moving from South Africa, where they were still practicing apartheid, which is segregation. And, you know, I moved to the south of the States, moved to where there was obviously no segregation, and went to school with kids from all backgrounds. And that was a culture shock in a good way. I mean, I love the fact that I had that instead of going to school with all kids from the same backgrounds. But I had no friends when I first moved here, and I had an accent, and kids made fun of me. And, you know, for the first 5 or 6 years that I was here in the States, I had to defend myself from being made fun of, from being beat up on. And it got to the point where, you know, I got not, I don't want to say I was a badass, because I was, you know,
like you were a badass. I'll say you're a little badass, John.
Like a little 10 or 11 year old. But I got to the point where, like, I would work out as a 10 and 11 year old so that I was strong enough to fight on the playground if I was picked on for my accent or for my background. And and when I beat somebody up after they'd picked on me, they stopped picking on me. And it became kind of this thread in my life, like, hey, I've got to defend myself. And then I started to see others in you know, in life who couldn't stand up for themselves, and I saw them getting bullied, and I would beat up the bully. And I think that may have had something to do with my wanting to serve in the military, and then specifically be in special operations. So there's, you know, yes, it was a micro trauma that ultimately served me well, but what did it not serve me? How did it not serve me? There's still this underlying fear of being made fun of. This want to continually be validated as somebody who can be loved. You know, we're going to go through the 7 limiting beliefs. I think that there are several of those limiting beliefs that were caused from my move from South Africa to the States. Now, looking back on it all, I'm ultimately very thankful for that move and everything that I learned from it. And, you know, living here in the States, growing up in the States, very privileged and very happy for that move. But there's still that underlying trauma that a 7-year-old struggles with. So that was definitely one of my personal experience.
And here you are, like, fighting for justice. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you know, you said, like, it's protecting yourself. And I was like, oh, I'm such a badass. I can help other kids, you know? And here you are, you know, defending our country, you know, like, from unjust injustice and stuff like that. So, I mean, you know, it's interesting how, you know, these can kind of play out in our lives. And then that's a really a big part of the book here, is that self-sabotaging. And, you know, I guess it's not all bad. I mean, would we have the show if you didn't? Probably not. If you moved from South Africa, I wouldn't have the show. But, like, you would not be the man that you are today if it wasn't for the way you're treated as a kid. Right. And I'll go into I talked about in our episode with Pratt with Dr. George about my experience with a camera as a kid and being embarrassed and kind of being, you know, shamed a little bit and never picking up that camera again. But another one that really very, very challenging for me, and it played out, it still plays out, John. It's not as bad now, but my ability to read as a kid was very challenged. I don't know why it was. I'm not like a dumb kid at all. Like I limited my ability to read out loud because maybe my first early experiences, I'm talking like, you know, second, third grade, when you're just reading basic passages. And this is like, you know, back in the late 70s, 80s, and this is the way they would conduct school. And I wasn't a good verbal reader. I think at that time, even I had, like, you know, I wasn't, you know, ADHD wasn't a thing. And so I had really trouble focusing, even sitting down and reading on my own. So I wasn't getting better at reading, you know, quietly. And so that obviously, you know, would manifest into me not being able to read out loud. And I would just feel such anxiety when I would be asked to read out loud. That I would be so, I remember feeling this experience experience in my chest. And again, I was like young and I didn't really necessarily know what I was feeling or why I was feeling. And plus the school system at that time, you know, there wasn't this, I forget what they call it, like social emotional kind of, you know, really the schools weren't, you know, looking into the emotional realm as a potential way or a problem that a student might be experiencing. So it was just like, it was a mechanical thing. He's like, oh, I was labeled a bad reader, you know, and I was put in like a bad section for readers. And it was just like, it just made me feel even worse and worse and brought up more anxiety. So anytime I was asked to read, it was awful. And then, you know, jump into my, when I was an actor, starting in my late 20s and 30s, like I'd have to cold read, you know, for an audition. And it was just, it was in order to overcome that devastation, I would take time on my own. For months, I would just get up first thing in the morning and I would just read, I'd pick up a book and read a passage for like, you know, 15, 20 minutes into recorder and to go back and listen to it and kind of, you know, started to learn like how I can read more effectively, more efficiently, but also have more of a, you know, a flow as I read. And, you know, we started doing the show a long time ago, John. I mean, those feelings started to come up again and they're still very, very subtly in the background. But like now I'm just more confident. You know, I know I can read, like we're writing a book, you know what I mean? So, and I read well, I tell myself, and I do read well, continually improving, but I write well. So just like, but that just stayed with me for a long, 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 long time. And it started at such a young age and it manifested itself like still, and I'm 50 now and it's still subtly in the background. And sure. It's just amazing how these things just are there. Until we become aware of them, and mindfulness helps me to become aware of it, calm down and make a change. But yeah, what are you going to say?
Well, you know, you said it's subtly there in the background and it's subtly there in the conscious mind, right? Like, you know, it's there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But let's talk about the conscious versus the unconscious mind or subconscious, right? Mm-hmm. In the book, they talk about the size, the physical size of the conscious versus the subconscious mind. The subconscious mind makes up 85% of our brain, of our mind, while 15% is in the conscious. That's in terms of size. But as far as bits of information processed, the conscious mind represents only 1/10,000th of 1% of the total brain's function. So, that was mind-blowing. So all the things that are happening every day in our mind, the conscious thoughts that we have, you multiply those times, 100,000, something like that, for the number of thoughts and feelings and emotions and bits of information that are processed in the subconscious. So the thought of your not being able to read well, it's still back there in the conscious mind, just subtly, but what is it doing in the subconscious mind, right? It may be much bigger than that and it may be affecting
it.
So we've got to talk about ways to change those, that limiting belief, change the and repattern that thought about yourself. But I love the metaphor they used in the book too. Basically, the flea and the elephant. The flea being the conscious mind, and the elephant being the subconscious mind. And if a flea that thinks he or she is in control and is sitting there on top of an elephant and says, "You know what? I want to go to the beach." But the elephant says, "You know what? I want to go into the jungle." Guess where you're going? You're going where the subconscious mind, the elephant, wants to take you. You're going to the jungle.
Right.
So we have to be aware of the subconscious mind and then address the thoughts where a lot of these limiting beliefs reside. We have to address them there. I'm going to talk about ways to do that. So let's, you want to talk about the limiting beliefs, man?
You know, I thought, yes, I think one thing just from the book, I thought it'd be nice to, if I can read from the book, John, and not fuck it up, right? And
get nervous. Let's do it.
Anyway, but I thought it was interesting. Traumatic resonance is something that they talk about. And so it says traumatic resonance. So this is called resonance, a word that literally means sounds again. When the vibrations of two different phenomena have a similar shape or frequency, we say they resonate with each other. Another term for this phenomenon is called sympathetic vibration. We often find that in early childhood experience, we leave will leave its mark, and then will be reinforced or reactivated by events later in life that resonate with the earlier event, much as sound of a car backfiring can trigger a traumatic memory of combat. So just a little, so this is, you know, it's in the emotional realm, it's in the energetic realm, you know, it's, I think it's really fascinating, like to really break down the consciousness of how we are and how all this stuff plays out. So it's, you know, I think a lot of, I mean, I know sometimes like the way I think of the mind or way that I early thought of the mind or earlier thought of how the mind works, it's just, you know, it's just all very kind of linear and very like A, B, and C, but it's much more complex. I mean, you know, you just talked about like, you know, the, you know, that iceberg, you know, the tip of the iceberg, you know, and the other 99% of it is below the surface. And that's what's really controlling like what we do and how we do things, how we feel, you know, and then the actions that we take based on those beliefs and those things that are running in the background and the patterns of behavior that, you know, until we become aware of them, until we really start to self-examine, and until we like take a pause and realize like, wait, something seems to be off here because I keep repeating and sabotaging myself in the same way, you know, maybe I should take a moment, get mindful, go seek some professional help, and then see why I keep my life is where it is, where I want to be over here. You're like the flea wants to be all the way over here, celebrating, loving, enjoying, you know, experiencing life in a full and rich way. But we're still down in the doldrums, or can't really seem to move up or you know, move our position in our life or society because of what's going on in the background, this fog of distress. But let's drop into these. We'll drop into these seven limiting beliefs, and these are the most common ones that I really kind of enjoyed getting into here. So let's start. I'm gonna come back and read to the book. What we got? Page 35, 36. Yes. Okay. So here we go. The brain can change its wiring in response to novel information. The more powerful and emotionally charged the information is, such as happens in traumatic experiences, the more rapid and significant the development of a new neural connection will be. And the more this information is repeated, the more these new neural pathways tend to form. We've heard this many times. I know, what's his name? Synapses that fire together, wire together. That's and this is how we form beliefs. We literally grow them like a dynamic topometry of the mind. So this is like we're just kind of warming into what these seven beliefs are. And these seven common misbeliefs are: number one, I am not safe. And just like every, as I read these, we're going to break these down individually. Just like maybe close your eyes as you listen and just kind of absorb this information. I am not safe. Number two, I am worthless. Three, I am powerless. Four, I am not lovable. Five, I cannot trust anyone. Six, I am bad. Seven, I am alone. Those are the seven. And why don't we just jump into I am not safe. And I'll just jump into just again, self-preservation, the urge to protect our own safety and survival, is the strongest of all instinctual drives. This impulse starts on the most basic physiological level. And as we grow, it extends to our emotional lives and the sense of identity. Eventually, as we become adults, and for many of us have children of our own, that impulse of preservation extends into our families. Whether this threat to survive is literally true or only a perception makes no difference at all in the terms of the impact the experience has on us. And in situations when we perceive threats or perceive threat, you know, serves as the asteroid, we meant the asteroid strike, like on an emotional ecology, it can result in persistent belief that keeps us in a permanent state of hypervigilance, unease, and anxiety for our safety, even when there is absolutely no rational threat in our surroundings. That is kind of the gist of I am not safe. That's kind of interesting. Yeah, go for it, John. The
I am worthless piece. So, and this kind of comes back to my wanting to continually validate myself. But yeah, if you have more on I am not safe.
I would just like to read, you know, so this is how, you know, what I really like about the book, and again, we suggest you read it. They actually take this, you know, in this case, I am not safe. And this is how this is the thinking that might be running in the background or maybe even aware of these thoughts sometimes. But, you know, keep an ear open for this because this is how it might, you know, here are some of the forms this belief can take. I cannot protect myself. I am in danger. Everything around me is dangerous. There is no safe place for me. I am vulnerable. It's not okay to show my emotions. That's something that I think men can really identify, right? With, you know, it's not okay, not safe for me to express my emotions. And last I have here, I've been abandoned. And these are all the ways that, and thinkings, and obviously there's lots of feelings that go along with these thinking when I'm not safe. And you brought up, John, one of the things that could really open up this doorway and the experience of you not being safe is like, you know, having a troubled home life or having a troubled home life as you grew up. Like we talk about in the yoga world, you know, there's seven basic chakras, and isn't it interesting that there's seven, you know, different limiting beliefs, and they start with the most bottom level, which is safety. And the most bottom chakra in yoga is called is the one all about our home life, and it really are we grounded. It's like it's our most basic survival needs: sex, money, food, and water. You know, and a roof over our head. And if they have been very dicey as you're growing up, right? This could also lend to this whole limiting belief that I'm not safe. So just some things there about I'm not safe. Any comments, John, or we can just go into the next?
Yeah, I mean that's an easy one. There's definitely events that can happen as you're growing up that can lead to that belief. But even as an adult, you know, that's one of the things that lead to so many military members suffering from post-traumatic stress they bring back what they've seen from the battlefield and experienced from the battlefield. And they may be going to Starbucks and have that hypervigilance, like turning your back on the door because you don't know who's coming through the door. You know, that limiting belief can definitely be instilled in us, I think, throughout our entire lives. It just depends on what happens to us. Micro traumas or large traumas, they can definitely instill these limiting beliefs. So I'll talk about I am worthless, this next limiting belief. In the book, it says, this I am worthless belief often stems from growing up in an environment of being criticized or evaluated negatively, as was the case with Gene, or from incidents where we are put on the spot and embarrassed, as was the case with Richard. Whatever the particulars of the event or original circumstances, we begin with a singular situation and then generalize that to become a blanket statement about ourselves, our abilities, and our value as a human being. At its extreme, this conviction of one's own worthlessness can lead to self-destructive or hopeless thoughts, including suicide, the ultimate expression of lack of self-worth. More commonly, it manifests as a nagging sense of inadequacy. People with the I am worthless belief often have difficulty asserting themselves in any situation, whether that means asking for a raise or asking for a date. Another common expression of this belief is, I am not good at. And I'm sure you've all said that at some point, right? The imposter syndrome that we've spoken about on the on the show before. I am not good at math. I'm not good at mechanical things. I'm not very good at social situations. I don't know how to talk to the opposite sex. I can't dance. I can't sing. And then some of the infinite variations of this theme are, I am not worthy, I am a fraud, I will never be successful, I cannot succeed, I have to be perfect, I am inadequate, I am unimportant, I am insignificant, I am incompetent, I am not good enough, smart enough, and the list goes on.
Right.
How many of you our listeners have felt that before. If you're listening live, you know, throw in your thoughts, comments, what it is you're feeling as we're saying these, because it's powerful. When I was reading this, I was like, oh my gosh, these guys, they are like opening up my psyche and just reading what I feel. So it was pretty powerful reading that section, the I am worthless section. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's also worth saying here, people with the I am worthless belief often have difficulty asserting themselves in any situation, whether it means asking for a raise or asking someone on a date.
Yeah.
Right? It's another manifestation. Also, part of this is like another version of this is I'm a failure. You know, this belief involves the fear of success as well as the fear of failure. And who can identify with that, right? And there are, two sides of the same coin. That's a hard one for me. Actually, when I just talked about me reading, John, and my trouble reading, and at the bottom of the page, of the book, I wrote my reading as a youngster, anxiety. You know, this is I'm worthless belief often stems from growing up in an environment that of being criticized or evaluated negatively, as was the case with Gene. I think you kind of read this already. Yeah.
Right.
Yep. So it's just like it runs deep, and again, it can start very young. You know, at such a young age, like I guess we're always looking for outside validation from our parents, and protecting us and taking care of us. And, when we don't live up to their expectations, especially if we have an extremely critical parent, how many times have you heard like, what's wrong with you? Like, oh, yeah. This is so simple. Like, why don't you get it? You know, instead of being patient, and just be like, hey, you know what? Like, it's okay. Like, let's talk about what's going on. You know, that'd be, I guess, good parenting. But it's like, and also I'm not like, or being mean to parents out there. It's like, you're doing the best you can, but you're also like, typically, unless you become more mindful and kind of worked with this stuff on your own, you're just typically repeating the same patterns of being raised as your parents did with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just like, it's crazy how patterns repeat and, it happens within us internally, but you also can see our repeating patterns, when we deal with other people.
For sure.
Cause that's the way kind of we've been trained at such a young age. So really fascinating. Anything else with this one, John, or we can move on to the next?
Let's move into, we're just going to just touch on each one of these seven limiting beliefs. So far, if you're just now tuning in, we're covering the seven limiting beliefs that are covered in the book, The Code to Joy. Mm-hmm. We've covered I am not safe, and we covered I am worthless. Now we're going to jump into the next one, I am powerless.
I am powerless. Yes, I am. This is a part of growing up, part of becoming an adult when we feel powerful, we believe that we can accomplish anything we set our mind to. And the fact that we believe this galvanizes our mind and our body to help us to do just that. Unfortunately, the same is true for our limiting belief to the event that we come to believe that we have no control over events. We tend to give up control. When we believe we are powerless, we give away our power. This belief is similar in a way to the belief that I am worthless. The difference is that people with the I am powerless belief do not see themselves as worthless. They just don't see themselves as having the ability to assert or exercise their worthiness in a way that will have an impact. So that's a little bit on the power. And one more I'll read here. Those of us that have this I am powerless belief in our own powerlessness often become withdrawn and learn to avoid social situations. To the degree that we act this way, the people around us pick up on these subtle cues and start treating us the way that we expect to be treated. People start ignoring your opinions and thoughts, treating you as if you don't exist. It's not that they don't like you. They just don't think about you, which is, think about that. That's pretty intense. So it's just like, if you're giving off this vibe of I am powerless, people are picking up on that. And You know, they might just kind of steamroll you or even just kind of ignore you. And I don't know, John, if you've experienced people like that.
We did the episode of the victim versus the victor or the
back in the day,
what the title was, but basically the victim mentality. Mm-hmm. That to me is what resonates with the I am powerless limiting belief. Mm-hmm. And you can't control anything. Everything that's happening is happening to you. Nothing is happening for you. And it's a mentality shift that we have to make in order to feel a sense of worth, a sense mm-hmm. of a sense of accomplishment. And honestly, if you continually walk through life with feeling I am powerless, then you know what's the point? Like what's the point of doing anything? You're like, well, if I work hard, it doesn't matter because I won't succeed. If I work hard, it doesn't matter because the system is rigged against me.
Right.
So having that sense of powerlessness is like you said, very tied to the worthlessness. Like what's the point? So it's the victim mentality. And if you can shift from being the victim and things happening mm-hmm. to you to mm-hmm. seeing things happening for you, whether they're good or bad, then I think you can work towards achieving that sense of joy. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not going to be joyful all the time, but you can work towards having that sense of joy or fulfillment more often.
You have the power to seek joy. You know, if you hold your power, and I think you're bringing up also an important distinction that they mentioned in the book. It's like intrinsic versus extrinsic, you know, intrinsic in the sense of like, you know, really getting to know yourself, getting to the self, like from Dr. Frank, right? You know, the 8 C's of the self, like that, and then creating self energy or experiencing self energy and self leadership. That's a really deep sense of power. And then you can, you know, with that intrinsic and that internal sense of power, then, you know, you're going to be powerful in your life and not like dominator or controlling people, but, you know, owning your decisions, owning, you know, what you're doing, how you're doing things, your beliefs, you know, you're going to have power behind them instead of, you know, whimsically, you know, just kind of shifting, you know, whatever the most popular, you know, or whatever else the consensus is, you know, amongst the group. And if you're constantly trying to find power outside, then you're just going to be so incredibly easy manipulated right now.
Right.
And I think, like, you know, just to briefly touch with, you know, we did our episode on politics, and that's what politics are power. And, you know, when we have the power to self-determine but if we constantly give our power away to people that we think have our best interest in mind and don't really understand getting into the power of, you know, there's you know, that self, you know, on the inside, then we're just so easily led, so easily manipulated. And then we get so far away from, you know, that, you know, really being yourself and really being powerfully yourself, that it's just like, oh, how did I get here? Well, because you haven't been, you know, accessing your own power, which is really important. I think this is also the way it kind of looks like and can sound like in your life. I'm not in control. I'm helpless. I'm weak. I don't matter. Ooh, that hurts when I hear that one. I'm invisible. I heard actually some woman say that in a class a long time ago. She's like, I'm invisible. Nobody sees me. And I just felt so awful to her. Mm. And at the same time, I was thinking, well, that's the energy you're putting out in the world. So no one is going to see you. And I can't stand up for myself or I'm trapped. So those are some ways that are some thinking and feelings that go along with that thinking that manifest through that whole idea of I'm powerless.
Right. And I see as far as I'm invisible with being a parent, sometimes when my children act up, rather than going over and yelling at them, I will pick them up, because most of the time when they're acting up so that they are seen, so that you pay attention to them. Yeah. And I will go over to them. I'll pick them up. I'll look them in the eye and I'll say, I see you. Mm. Not like I see you being bad, but I see you. I know you are a person. I see you and you are important to me. And they change almost instantly just by saying that one thing, I see you.
Wow.
So it's pretty powerful. And that ties into the piece of being lovable. right?
Yeah. Let me just actually remember Luke a couple weeks back. He says, "What's the?" You know, I asked him. You know, if there's a commonality when the light bulb goes on for men, and he says, "Yes, there is." He goes, "When a man is seen."
Yeah.
When a man is like really seen non-judgmentally, not as you should be this kind of man or that kind of man, or you're just a man, but really being a man and being the man that you are and really being seen in your, all of your light, all of your colors, all of your uniqueness, all of your characteristics. That's powerful for anybody. And that's also a form of compassion, you know, just really being present and really just seeing somebody as they are, right? Not who you want them to be or what you feel they should be, or putting some sort of, you know, veneer of like, oh, like an enemy veneer because that person's a man or because another person has a different color skin or something like that, or doesn't dressing the way that you want. Just being seen as you are really gives somebody that, you know, can really help maybe open them up to realizing that, you know what, I do have power on the inside. So
right.
And then I am lovable. And this kind of flows nicely into
it. It does, man.
You know, if you're seeing somebody and you're letting someone know that they are loved, but go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, so being seen allows you to feel that you are lovable. And the inverse of that is the next limiting belief that we're going to talk about. The fact that you think that you are not lovable. The I am not lovable belief most often goes back to our parents or primary caretakers. It can stem from having had the sense that one or both parents loved one sibling more than the other. It may be that one or both parents was particularly cold, aloof, undemonstrative, or simply not available. Such situations and experiences may have nothing to do with the reality of the parent's love for the child. And this one's an important one for me to share, because sometimes I feel that, you know, parents, especially these days, we can get very wrapped up in work. Even while we are at home, we have busy lives and we're trying to provide, and we convince ourselves that we have to do work all the time. But this is what the child perceives. Mm. Even if your parents were wonderful, loving, encouraging, and supportive, there may easily have been incidents when you perceived them as them withdrawing or withholding their love and support for you. They may have been burdened by a heavy work schedule or distracted by a health issue. Sometimes the most innocent circumstances can be misperceived by a child as abandonment. Then this goes on to variations of this belief include, I do not deserve love. I have no identity. I do not deserve to have a loving relationship. I should expect to be betrayed. That one, man. Oof. Yeah. That's
It says here at the end of that, take a moment and see if these statements resonate with you. And what's resonating for me, John, is you know, I was a middle child and I was very capable of doing a lot of things. Like, you know, I've been, you know, gifted with some intelligence, so I can figure out a lot of things on my own. Like, I still am, like, very observant, so I could just kind of watch somebody do something and I can do it a few times and I can start picking it up and keep getting better at it by doing it. And because I was a pretty capable child and I had an older brother that, you know, I mean, that it, only 16 months apart, an older brother that was like, you know, the oldest typically from my understanding, and I'm not a psychologist, just to remind everybody, you know, they get like, you know, they get the brunt of parenting because like they're the ones that are trying all these new things, you know, or just being a child and you know, they're constantly being drawn back in line. I was actually the baby for 3.5 years until my little brother was born, and then I became the middle child. When I was my mom told me this story like maybe, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, that I was like, wow, or maybe 10 years ago. She's like, when you were about 4, 4.5, and my little brother was like 6 or 9 months, I'm sitting at lunch, you know, having lunch with like my mom was, you know, at home. I was there, and I look right at my mom and I point to my little brother. I'm like, well, when is he leaving? And my mom's like, you know, when is he leaving? And my mom's like, oh, he's not leaving. He's here to stay. But like, I mean, just think where that comes from deep down inside. It's just like, you know, because he, you know, for 3 years I was the prince. You know, 3-4 years, I was like the baby, you know, and I was no longer the baby. And my place in the family shifted dramatically into this middle role where it's like my brother's getting a lot of attention for just being the older kid. My little brother is, he's the baby, so he's getting a lot of care. And I'm just kind of left in the middle. And like, and one thing that I know my parents had said quite often, and they told me this also later on, it's just like, oh, you don't have to worry about him. Oh, he's fine. He'll figure it out. And and now, like, look, I'm not lovable. And here I am, you know, just to get a little deeper, John, and a little bit more embarrassing, maybe. You know, no, here I am, man, 50, being, still being single. Raw. Yeah, I mean, just still, yeah, being right here, I'm 50, still single. And I kind of feel still this,
ladies,
like, unlovable.
Ladies, hear that? Hey, single man.
Good man, mindful man, strong man, tall man, you know.
Good looking man.
Good looking man. Thank you, healthy man. You know, it's like, and I am lovable. I'm learning that I am lovable.
So lovable, man.
It's yeah, and I love you, John. And John, I know John loves me. And I thank you, everyone, for listening. I feel the love from you as well.
If you love Will, but, put it in the comments.
yeah, I need it right now, please. But you know, like I, you know, I mean, here I am, right? You know, and I'm not blaming anybody. My parents, they did the best they could. But this is something that, you know, has been brought to my attention. That little story I told you, I didn't know I said that when I was 4, but I did. And that just kind of goes into, you know, this is who I am today. So I thought that was God, that one really hits deep, you know. And I think a lot of other people can relate to that as well. So, yeah. Anything else,
let's
gonna check comments here too.
There we go. We got a comment. Flexible man. You're a flexible man too.
Oh yeah. Thanks, David. Right. Jack says here, after 6 foster homes, and the 7th was a charm for me. My examples were all over the place for parenting. Betrayal was a hard feeling to overcome. So that's, you know, that's Jack moving through foster care. So God, talking about not having a foundation, right? Not having a foundation as a home, and then, like, you know, and not even having, you know, having parents that you're constantly looking at, and having different authority figures in which you're continuing, you know, looking to. God, thanks for sharing that, Jack. I feel you on that one. And then the next one, limiting belief, is I cannot trust anyone. And here's what it looks like. As we are first growing and learning our way through life, trust is the glue that holds the world together. We learn to talk, walk, and interact with our environment and with other people without a framework that depends on trust. If we cannot trust our senses, our own judgment, our environment, and the people around us, then we would have no solid foundation to build upon, and life would be completely unpredictable and terrifying. It's no surprise then that when our sense of trust is violated or shaken, it can threaten the basis of our very existence, or feel like it does. People with the belief I cannot trust anyone often feel they're always on guard, suspicious, or ill at ease. And this, I thought this was fun. They may be, you know, so people that have this, I cannot trust anyone, they manifest as they could be backseat drivers, micromanagers. So all you micromanagers out there, you know.
Whoa, are you looking at me? Issue.
No, I was looking at the microphone, John, and the book, okay? Look at this guy. He's like.
My self-limiting belief is showing through.
I know, right? Totally. Right. Or they can be control freaks, like, I feel some of that control sometimes. And those that drive other people nuts, or they might have an equally hard time trusting themselves. And as a consequence, never let themselves fully participate in the fun unfolding around them. They may feel anxious about something unpredictable or spontaneous, or seem not quite present in their own bodies, keeping themselves at a remove. And then the last part here, there are two typical sources for this belief. First, experience with the key authority figures in early lives, especially our parents, once again, parents. And second, the small incremental disappointments that can happen in life. For those who have a more solid, healthier foundation, these disappointments slide off and do not have lasting damage. For others who are more vulnerable, they can stick and create an ongoing problem, adding to the neural network that says, I cannot trust. Wow. Cool. And, you know, has relations and I am not safe. Here's what it looks like. Here's our variations of belief. Take a moment and see if they resonate with you. I cannot believe what anyone is telling me. I don't trust anyone in authority. I feel like we're talking about a political episode again. I am not a trusting person. So going on your own self, I am not a trusting person. I am not a trustworthy person. Like, oof, God, I can only... I would not. I don't want to. Oh God, that's an awful feeling. I can't be trusted. I can't trust myself. I never make the right choice. I am bad luck, and I can't trust my judgment. So, God, a lot of external and internal there. You know what I mean? Your own trustworthiness and your own sense of trust, and then relationship to other people, and then also the outside. It's like, you know, authority sucks. Like, I can't trust anybody, and that's a hard one. Trust, you can develop that again, mindfulness. These practices, sorry, John. Can really. This is where you can start to develop that trust, and trusting within, and then. Hopefully seeing the world as a trusting place and knowing that it's safe. But yeah, John.
No, I was just thinking of a relationship that I was in at one point where the girl had found a letter that her dad had written to himself about her. And it was, ooh, you know, not meant for her to find, but he was like, she is manipulative. She is this. And it caused her a lot of trouble trusting him, but it also caused a lot of trouble in trusting others. And so there's definitely, you know, things that we do openly, but we also have to be careful of the things that we do that we may not think are being seen, but they are being seen. And that could be through, you know, maybe a secret letter to yourself, but it could also be body language or, you know, the way that you carry yourself around someone, or coming back to the I'm not lovable piece, you say that you're present with your family, but really you're on your phone the whole time. Like you're cruising social media and you say, hey, I love you, but then you don't show that love. Well, how can you be trusted? Mm-hmm. And what does that show? That shows that people cannot be trusted. So if you can't trust your parents, can't trust your loved ones, then you start not trusting anyone, your friends, your colleagues, your politicians, like we talked about before. So it's a dangerous and slippery slope to get onto is the lack of trust. I cannot trust anyone.
Yeah, that's oh my God. And I'd imagine if you have that experience, that limiting belief of trust, it's like, how do you rebuild trust within yourself? How do you rebuild, you know, trust within the world? And it takes work, and it's probably, it's definitely worth any one of these limiting beliefs, like dig into them, especially this trust one as well. Like because then you're always looking over your shoulder. You can't trust anybody. You're always going to be suspicious. Like you're never going to, you know, trust anyone or what they're saying, what they're doing. You're always going to kind of, you know, walk around in the fog of this distress and just continually, I'd imagine, processing the world as a bad place, as a, you know, an ugly place, as a place that doesn't support you and your ambitions. And what is that going to do? How does that manifest, this trust issue?
Sure.
How does it manifest in the life that you want, the joy that you want, the things that you want to do? So incredibly,
you know, even peeling that onion back a little further, like what happens when you don't trust yourself, right? So you can't trust people around you, but you can't trust yourself. And I think that ties into the next limiting belief, I am bad. Let's jump into that. I'll take this one. There's hardly a child alive who hasn't been told that he or she has been bad by someone. He or she trusts and respects. I got to stop there for a second. One thing that I am trying to be very intentional about, my wife and I, about is we do not say you are bad. We say, hey, you're doing something that is bad. You're doing a naughty thing. And for some reason, my youngest one has picked up she's two. I won't go into names, but my youngest one, she says to my two older ones, bad so-and-so, bad so-and-so. She says, bad mama, bad dada. And then, you know, calls the other kids bad by their names as well. I'm like, you cannot say that. So it comes, it may come from the parents, but it may also come from the other siblings, and you have to nip it in the butt. So like we try to make sure we cut that off. Hey, you cannot say that. You cannot say that somebody else is bad. You're defining them as bad. So just thought that was kind of a funny, but also a little bit scary anecdote. But okay,
thankfully, I'll say, John, thankfully she's not an authority figure in your house, right? She's the youngest one, right?
So hopefully she thinks she is.
I'm sure. What a kid.
So anyway, so coming back to that first sentence, there's hardly a child alive who hasn't been told that he or she has been bad by someone, or he or she trusts and respects. For a young child still struggling to carve a sense of identity out of the welter of everyday experiences, simply being told no or don't do that can be received as the message, you are wrong, you are bad. That's normal. It happens to all of us. For some, though, the accusation sticks. Like Hester Prynne's Scarlet Letter, we all remember that book. The person with this self-limiting belief wears a badge of condemnation that colors every experience she has. The desire for our parents' and others' approval is innate in every one of us. Children naturally want to please their parents, and virtually every parent, at least at times, uses this vulnerability as a way to control the child's behavior. And then I'll flip to the next page here. There's a tendency in some families, though, to overdo this, taking it past the point of instruction and into the realm of condemnation. I say destruction rather than instruction. And for example, there's a difference between embarrassment and shame. Embarrassment is about a specific action of ours that has brought an unwanted attention. Shame is unwanted attention brought to us for who we are as a person, not just for something we've done. So here's an example. The child spills a glass of milk at the table and we say, what's the matter with you? How many times have I told you to be careful? These questions, of course, they have no answers. The child is left with no way to respond, and unless we provide one. And then flip that scenario. Imagine the parent coming to the same scolding, but then says, okay, look, go get some paper towel from the kitchen and just wipe it up. It's going to be okay. So that's kind of what could possibly lay the foundation for that limiting belief of I am bad. And then other forms of that, I am wrong, I am selfish and think only of myself, I'm guilty, I should be ashamed of myself, there is something wrong with me, I have disappointed myself, I'm terrible, I'm shameful, sinful, I cause misfortune, I deserve only bad things, I should have known better.
Wow.
Man, yeah. Every single time I read these, I'm like, oh yeah.
I know. So that whole idea, I'm guilty, which is associated with I am bad. Think about this is how it manifests in your life. Guilt seeks punishment, and those with this limiting belief tend typically, without consciously realizing it, to do things that are not good for them or that are contrary to their intended goal. And consciously held beliefs. In other words, so that's interesting. Like, so the whole guilt, like, you know, you're that could be the self-sabotaging loop because you're like living in this guilt because you feel this limiting belief is running in the background, you're being bad. So therefore you're constantly going out and, you know, seeking to be punished in some ways, which is like, that's the elephant, kind of managing the flea, you know, instead of the flea managing the elephant. So that's that just sits in the background, which is really rough. Cool. Last one, John, or any other comments on I am bad? You're bad, John. You're
Whoa.
Just kidding. Yeah, no, sorry. Just kidding.
Things just got weird, y'all.
I know. I'm just fucking kidding. I'm just kidding. I don't know. I got to have a little bit because we're getting heavy. So it's like, here's like
yeah,
a
yeah. No, good for you. Second, good for you. You know? I love it.
So I am alone. When we feel that that connection, and then we are never alone. Conversely, when we do not feel that sense of connection to God, to nature, to a larger family of humanity, to life itself, then when we are alone, we are alone. The quote, the eternal silence of these infinite spaces terrifies me, wrote the 17th century scientist Basil Pascal, whose mother died when he was young. Basil was just three. When people have no sense of connection outside themselves, it not only changes their outlook on life, it also changes their health. Their sense of hope diminishes, and with healthy immune system, with it, a healthy immune system. The body can respond by a gradual secession of that mysterious force that every medical profession knows as the will to live. So, this is like, I am alone. And it looks like this. Here's what it might sound like. Life is empty. There is no point in going on. So this can lead to suicidal ideation. There is no point in anything. I am disconnected from the world. I am disconnected from God. I'm angry at God. I'm angry at myself. And those are some of those I am alone, limiting beliefs and manifestations. So that's these have all been really hard to read, John.
I know, man.
but I think that's great, like the awareness that we're creating around these, because with awareness, and if you're hearing any one of these limiting beliefs, and you might be hearing many of them, and in the book, like right after that last one, they go into kind of a checklist, like read through them and check the ones off that might be resonating with you. You can do something about them. Go seek right. professional help. I mean, because I'll tell you that everyone is worthy of love. Everyone is worthy of deep connection. Everyone, it could be safe. Everyone can be trusting. But you need to. Nobody's going to rescue you. You need to step in the arena. Know that you need help. And there's nothing wrong with looking for help. There's nothing wrong with seeking help. There's nothing wrong with getting help. Because we all have the ability to be awesome human beings and get into that self, understand that self, and be led by the self. But this has been quite a journey so far, John.
It has. So let's get into if you identify that you have some of these self-limiting beliefs, mm-hmm. what do you do about it? Right.
Right.
And that's kind of the four. So the title of the book again is The Code to Joy, or rather just mm-hmm. Code to Joy, the four step right. solution to unlocking your natural state of happiness. Well, what is mm-hmm. that four step solution? So once you identify that you have a limiting belief, what caused that limiting belief? And now what are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And the four step process is covered throughout the book in chapters, but I'm just going to look at the appendix in the back here. It's kind of distilled down to what That's we can talk idea. About in the show, because mm-hmm. we're already past an hour here, man. I'm loving this episode though. So,
me too. Thanks.
The four step process is identify, clear, repattern, and then anchor. Mm. So identify. Clear, repattern, and anchor. And for step one, and Will, if you want to just go through the steps, I'll cover step one and then just
pass through these. Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm in Appendix A in the back.
Gotcha.
So step one is identifying, and I'm not going to apologize because this is raw, uncut, unapologetic. I'm not going to apologize for just reading from the book here, but I think it's so dense with information, and this information mm-hmm. is so critical to hear for at least one of our audience members and for ourselves. I know it resonates, talking about resonating with mm-hmm. many more. So I am reading. So there.
you are
no apology.
There. Got listen up.
Listen up, everybody. So step one, purpose. Identify. Step one is identify. And the purpose is to identify your strongest limiting beliefs. identify your asteroid strikes. In the book, they talk about the dinosaurs and the asteroid strike coming, kind of knocking up all the dust and it killing off the dinosaurs. But even with that dust there, the sun was still there. And we have to be able to get past those asteroid strikes in our lives. So identify your asteroid strikes. And to do that, we have to create a list of past events that you feel may have had a strong negative impact on how you see yourself and your world. Go through this list and determine which event seems to you has had the deepest or most significant impact. Next one is identify your strongest self-limiting beliefs. Identify your strongest self-limiting beliefs using the personal beliefs assessment. There's that in chapter 2. And then verify the elements you have identified. Use neuromuscular feedback. So in the book, they talk about this process, neuromuscular feedback, where the doctor will ask you, hey, do you feel that you had an event in your life that affected you prior to age 10? And if you say no, but there was one, here again, this is the subconscious outweighing the strength of the conscious mind. If you think that there was one, you hold your arm up and the doctor pushes down on your arm. And if you're lying to yourself, you may not even know it. If you're lying to yourself, you won't have the strength to hold your arm up. You're, I think it was 15 or 20% weaker physically when you are lying, even though you may not realize it. It's kind of like the lie detector tests out there. You may not know that you're lying sometimes. So use the neuromuscular feedback to review both lists and arrive at what you see as the single most pertinent past event and single most prevalent self-limiting belief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. There.
That neuromuscular feedback I thought was interesting because it's mind. They do like a test thing. Yeah. I've had this done to me before and like, you know, back around this time, like I was just like, why are you just like yanking in my arm? And she would ask me, this woman would ask me a question and then like my arm would go down or my arm would stay up. And it's like, you know, what I understand the neuromuscular, feedback is like when you are in the energy of truth, right? Truth is powerful and truth is stable, right? Whereas in a limiting belief or a disbelief or not being honest, right? It weakens you, it weakens your energy, and you don't have that tried and true strength. And that's when the arm goes down. They actually give a really great example of using this neuromuscular feedback system on some giant freaking bodybuilder or something like that who has arms as big as my torso, and like they have him come in and he's like, okay, try to push my arm down, you know. And they started testing him in certain ways, and you know, the first couple of ones like couldn't budge his arm. It's like, they would do something like what's your name, say your name, you know, like, you know, if you're telling the truth, the arm's not gonna go down. Or it's like, you know, and then say where you're born, I was born here, you know. And then you can kind of go into testing it and saying something that or asking something that might be true or false, and you'd be able to tell if it's false if the arm drops or if it's true if the arm stays up.
Yeah.
So like really very interesting, and it's been used in many different modalities, many different health professions to find that. But it seems very strange and esoteric and weird, but it's a real thing.
And talk about strange, esoteric and weird. I thought just that, and funny enough, just as I was kind of thinking that, there's a section in the book where it says, does this really work?
Yes.
And so it quotes, how do I know this is really working and the other person isn't just pushing harder on my arm? People often ask this. After all, couldn't this just be an example of the placebo effect in all our minds? It's a reasonable question. We wonder the same things ourselves when we first began exploring the process many years ago, but the results of neuromuscular feedback are objectively measurable by the tools and instruments of hard science. I won't go into the objective study there, but bottom line, it's real, y'all, just like meditation and mindfulness.
Yeah,
right. It's real.
Yeah, it is. And it's been tested and it's science-based. You know, it's not just some, you know, weird thing that, you know, that people are doing.
In the words of Anchorman, Will Ferrell at Anchorman, it's science.
You got to do the head flip again. It's science.
It's science. Right?
Here's step two in the step four process. It's clear. And, you know, so we just created a lot of awareness on this episode about like identifying what the limiting belief is. But then we get into book later on and gets into like how to begin to clear, repattern, and anchor. So clearing is, you know, really kind of getting into your body, getting balancing yourself. You know, they talk about using the cross hand breathing technique to help kind of get into a neutral place and calm the mind, calm the body by doing that. They have grounding exercises here, which is another kind of technique that they use. And then they have optional techniques as well to get into this clearing pattern, right? So it's identify, clear. So you're kind of like getting to a place that your mind is clear, your body's more clear and more energetically available for step number three, which go for it, John.
Yeah. So step number three is repatterning. So you would have to release these negative beliefs. And they talk about, you know, positive thinking positively. And I believe in that. And they do too. But the problem with positive thinking is that, again, the subconscious mind is believing something else.
So you have to elephant in the fleet. Right?
Yeah, you have to repattern this belief before you can start thinking positively for it to change. So you have to release these negative beliefs and instill new empowering beliefs in their place. And I won't go through the whole thing, but one of the visualizations that they use is visualizing putting these negative beliefs about yourself, these self-limiting beliefs, in a basket or in a balloon or in something, some type of object, putting that belief inside of it.
Or giving it to God, right? And for, you know, giving it to God, I'd imagine, is one of those things as well. But yeah, sorry.
And then basically letting it go. So visualizing a healing basket or other container of your choosing, place all the negative elements into that, and over 3 minutes, visualize it gradually disappearing or floating away, taking all those negative elements away. Then you do a pledge of acceptance. Then you imagine your ideal life for several minutes, and then you imagine your ideal adulthood. So those are ways that you can repattern. And then the final step is anchoring. And I'll turn that over to Will.
Yeah, and anchoring, you know, the purpose here is to ensure that the results of the first three steps will be deep and long lasting, right? So this is like really can create some change. So they have an anchoring hold here, continue scenes from your ideal life, right? And this is something that really helped me, John, after, you know, it'll be 2 years, John, that we were in Costa Rica doing a psychedelic retreat,
right? Yeah, next
month. And one thing that they brought up, and they use it as a tool to help move us through this transformational psychedelic experience, and then reused it again as we went into the integration program, was visualizing your ideal self, even writing it down and visualizing it and getting very intentional with that. Your future self and your ideal self is, and here comes up again, right? This is how powerful the mind is. If you have a very clear and specific, you know, image in your mind of that person, and not just, you know, again, specific of like, you know, what are the qualities of that person? How does that person walk? How do they talk? Like, how are they around a group of people? How are they with themselves? Like getting very, very clear about that image in your mind. And then through this anchoring practice and the steps, like stepping towards and beginning to live and change, you know, we've already kind of changed some of the patterns, but establishing a new root, a new self. And I keep coming back self again, right? And that self energy and that self leadership. But it takes these three other steps to get to the fourth. And this could take years or, you know, some of the things that they had talked about with the patients that they continually, many, many patients and that they talk about and people that they've worked with throughout the book, that this is such a powerful technique because it goes into the energy of things, which is we are just energetic beings in a human body. You can repattern rather quickly, but I think the willingness has to be there, and also the willingness to practice and be patient and not just expect like one and two is going to be done.
Sure.
You know, it could take you more time than someone else. But if the willingness is there, the courage is there, the dedication to change, you know, visualizing that ideal self, you can really make some significant changes in your life and maybe eradicate some of those the subconscious patterns that have been dictating your life up until now. And even says last year, while continually anchoring, hold, now visualizing the personal, and they have a whole personal symbol system, which is kind of unique. And I thought it was kind of interesting. But, you know, play with, you know, what I like about how they broke down the book is like, go with what you got, in the sense of like, you know, if this is the way our mind is and our mind responds very well to symbols or sounds or something like that, use them in order to create this new self. So they did such a great job in all of this. I wanted to read one thing about self-acceptance, which I thought, but I don't know if we, I thought that was really important. Actually, I put that on, the self-acceptance, I put that as a little IG post because I thought it was just so profound.
That's a plug for us. Follow us on Instagram.
Yeah, follow us on Instagram. Yeah, so we're pull shelf advocacy. Where is it? Sorry, John. Give me just one more moment.
Self acceptance is the piece that.
So I know I'm trying to find it. I'm trying to find it according to Lipton. Self efficacy. I can't find it. I don't know what happened.
Self acceptance was on page 149.
Oh, 149.
Okay. Self efficacy is so. Yeah. While you're looking for that, real quick, that I'll just summarize the fact that self efficacy is covered in the book, and it is really powerful section, and it talks about the individual's belief that they can execute behaviors necessary to produce specific performance attainments. So basically, it's your confidence in your ability to exert control over your own motivation, your behavior, your social environment, which we talked about. The limiting belief there is I'm powerless. So the reverse of that is having self-efficacy and actually fulfilling your self-fulfilling prophecy, if you will, like going after that and actually stepping into your own shoes is the term they used in the book, and which I really liked. I just wanted to mention that really quick while
you're because we have it here in the notes too. Yeah. And then here we are. Yeah, and really a lot of this starts with self-acceptance. And the next element in this step is the simple statement of self-acceptance and to have it, I am fully and deeply accept myself. I love what they said here from a scientific point of view. Self-acceptance is a superordinate concept, which is awesome. Think about like orientation, right? Superorient. So it's just like, if I can accept myself where I am, you know, who I am at this time, then I begin to bring myself in, orient myself into what is going on with me right now. And they go on to say, accepting yourself as you are puts you into the here and now. Until you have that clear starting point, any journey is going to be handicapped. If you don't accept something, it's extremely difficult to change it because you can't fight something and change it at the same time. The vast majority of people who are in distress, wanting to change their lives, do not accept themselves because they fear that doing so would mean affirming those same negative qualities or circumstances. They wish to change, but that isn't how it works. A denial leaves you powerless. Acceptance empowers you. Accepting yourself, and this is a great way to kind of close all this anyway. Yeah. Accepting yourself does not mean being satisfied with the status quo or giving up any hope for improvement. Quite the opposite. Deep and full self-acceptance puts you in the driver's seat, in a position of strength. It puts you in a place from which it becomes possible to change and grow powerfully. Often we tend to identify with our circumstances, and especially with our most challenging circumstances. If we have an illness or a damaged relationship or financial hardship, we may start to feel that the problem is us. But deep self-acceptance means I am not the disease. I am not the divorce. I am not the financial setback. Mm. Whatever is going on in your life is not who I am. It is simply what I am passing through at the moment. Another way of saying this is that this statement moves from an external loci, again, outside, external loci of control to an internal locus of control. Starting from a place of self-acceptance is a reclamation of self-efficacy. I fully and deeply accept myself. Boom.
Yeah, man. I would like to make a comment there, but I don't want to dull.
Keep it short, John. Keep it short.
I don't want to dull what you just dropped the mic there. So self-acceptance mindfulness allows you to do the real powerful self-acceptance. Don't define yourself as what it is you're going through. I hear that all the time. I do it all the time. I am right. Stressed. I am a stressed person. Well, not necessarily. You're just going through a stressful situation. I am depressed. I am anxious. Not necessarily. You might just be experiencing anxiety. You may be experiencing depression, and it's a stage that you can go through, and accepting that it's something that you're going through rather than it is how you are or who you are. That's the essence of self-acceptance. And I love that, man. I think that's how we should wrap it up. There's a lot more in this book. Fantastic tips, ways to live the healthier, happier life, ways to live joyful. Yeah, there it is, y'all. Code to Joy. So very much appreciate you all for tuning in today. I know it's a very dense, information-dense episode, but it's an information-dense book. And if you get a chance, pick it up, give it a read, and maybe implement some of the practices that they mention in there for yourself, for your loved ones, so that you can live that happier, healthier, more fulfilled life. I think we wrap it up there, brother.
Yeah, likewise. This is it. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in once again. We'll do our grounding practice. John will lead us through that. Yeah. And I have nothing else to say except, hey, you're valuable, you're powerful, you're worthy of change and a happy life and finding more joy. And hopefully what we've talked about today, kind of the Cliff Notes version of the Code to Joy, was helpful. Maybe just get the audiobook if it's tough to read. And it's a very life-affirming book for sure.
There you go. Yeah, and if you felt it was worth your time, share it with others. Please share what it is we're doing, not just so that we can have more followers for the show, but so that we can spread mindfulness and this joy, the joy that we have in doing the show and the joy that we share in doing the show, but also in the joy from this book, Code to Joy. All right, enough. Let's get into our grounding practice, y'all. Go ahead and let's just bring our attention to our breath, and don't feel the need to force anything just yet. Just initially just focusing our attention on our inhalation, on your inhalation and your exhalation. Nice deep breath in. Nice and easy though. And let it go nice and easy. And just like we did at the beginning, as you inhale, breathe in love and peace. And as you exhale, breathe out that tension and anxiety and those limiting beliefs. Let them go. Let them go. Let them go. One more nice, deep, easy breath in, nice and light. Hold at the top and let it go. Let it go. Let it go. And now just bring in some of those micro movements, maybe rolling your shoulders, wiggling your fingers, blinking your eyes open if they were closed. Thank you all again for joining us today. Fantastic episode. Will, thank you for doing all this work. I appreciate you. I love you, man. You are lovable. You are safe. You are all the things that you believe or you may have had those limiting beliefs about in the past. You are all those things, the good things, the good sides of those limiting beliefs, right? So you are safe. You are worthy. You are powerful. You are lovable. You can trust people. You are not bad and you are not alone. And that goes for everyone listening too. So thank you, Will. And thank you all for tuning in. Until next time.
Thank you, John.
Take care.
Peace. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for joining us today. We hope you walk away with some new tools and insights to guide you on your life journey. New episodes are being published every week, so please join us again for some meaningful discussion. For more information, please check out mentalkingmindfulness.com.